You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show, Matthew Jamieson and James Schneider are here to review the day's top news stories, from violence in Libya to the ongoing persecution of journalists in Egypt to today's attacks in Kenya.
We in Kenya are committed to this fight. My fellow citizens, join us in this particular battle and to ensure that we root it out from our midst.
Then we'll head to the UK to discover Bristol's booming independent media scene.
Coming here tonight and packing out this room with people who are really passionate about these magazines, I'm genuinely quite taken aback.
We'll also hear from our correspondent in Amsterdam and later in the show.
All right, what's going on? Ideas?
There's a kidnapper and there's a watcher.
He might be watching me.
Who's watching you?
We'll reluctantly desist from thrashing at the twitching remains of Grace of Monaco to go through some of the better movies at this year's Cannes Film Festival. All that, plus some music and more besides, coming up right here on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. An action-packed 60 minutes ahead, but ahead of all that, Bill Bingham has the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News report says many as 13 people have died and at least 70 others have been wounded during two explosions in a busy market in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Police say the first occurred in a minibus, the second in the large open-air Gikomba market. One suspect has been arrested near the market and another was detained in another part of Nairobi. The blasts were caused by homemade bombs. At least 67 people died last September when the Westgate shopping centre in Nairobi was bombed by the Somalian terrorist group Al-Shabaab. The latest explosions came as hundreds of tourists began returning home after warnings of a high threat of terrorism. These tourists say they're sad to leave.
We've been here for 9 days now. We've had a safari. We've had a really good holiday, great time. Just really disappointed now that we've been told to go home.
The Kenyan people are absolutely brilliant, and it is such a shame that we have to cut our holiday short because of other people. We feel for the people we have left at the hotel who work there.
Narendra Modi says he wants to fulfil the dreams of 1.2 billion people after sweeping to power in historic elections in India. The final count has yet to be declared, but the Hindu Bharatiya Janata Party has surpassed the 272 seats needed to avoid a coalition, ending 10 years of Congress Party rule. It's the first majority government India has elected in 30 years. Mr. Modi told supporters, "There are no enemies in democracy, only opposition." He said he would take the voters' love and convert it into progress. The stock market in Mumbai has responded to the BJP's win by leaping 6%, sending the rupee to an 11-month high. A United Nations report says there's been a sharp deterioration in human rights in the east of Ukraine. A monitoring panel says between April the 2nd and May the 6th, police allowed armed militias to seize whole towns, while journalists and local officials were unlawfully detained. Their report, which Russia has criticised as being politically motivated, says police and local authorities in eastern Ukraine connived in illegal acts. Sweden's Foreign Minister Carl Bildt, who's visiting Kiev, says the elected representatives of eastern Ukraine should decide their future.
It's for them, really, to go out and anchor their policies with the people. Because otherwise there's a risk of, if you take steps and say that you invite all of these green guys with guns to the table, then you sort of delegitimize the democratic institutions of the country. And that, I think, would be long-term damage.
Turkish police have fired tear gas and water cannon at thousands of anti-government protesters in the eastern town of Soma, where around 300 miners died on Tuesday. The protest happened after the mine operators held a news conference to deny any negligence over the disaster. There have been angry anti-government rallies across Turkey for the last 3 days over what's become the country's worst ever mine disaster. Nigeria's president has cancelled his first planned visit to the village from which nearly 300 girls were kidnapped due to security fears. Instead of going to Chibok in northeast Borno State, Good Luck Jonathan is flying direct from the capital Abuja to Paris for a regional summit to discuss Boko Haram and wider security problems. Boko Haram's leader, Abubakar Shekau, last week threatened in a video to sell the girls into slavery unless the government freed rebels being held, but the president has ruled out a prisoner exchange. 223 girls are believed to still be missing. The United States government has fined General Motors the maximum $35 million US for postponing the recall of vehicles with faulty ignition switches. The company has admitted 13 people died in crashes linked to the problem, but lawsuits say the actual death toll is at least 53. GM says it knew about the problem for more than a decade, although car manufacturers are supposed to report safety defects within 5 days of their being discovered. GM did not recall the cars until this year. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Bill. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. It's coming up for 18.07 in London, which will be 13.07 in New York. Joining me now for the first half of the show with their take on the news here in the studio is Matthew Jameson, who's a consultant fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, and James Schneider, who's the editor-in-chief of Think Africa Press. Welcome both to the programme. We'll start in Nairobi, where at least 10 people are dead and 70 injured following two explosions in Gikomba Market in the centre of the city. In response, two British travel firms have begun evacuating hundreds of tourists from Mombasa, citing a threat level that they describe as unacceptably high. The obvious question first I shall put to you, James, who is likely to have done this?
Well, it's likely to be Al-Shabaab, the Somali Islamist militant group that since Kenya invaded Somalia to try to push out Al-Shabaab and then later join the AU force. There's been a ramping up of Al-Shabaab bombings and also, you know, most famously the Westgate attack in response to this. So it's very, very likely to be Al-Shabaab or, you know, Al-Shabaab linked groups, because there are a couple as well.
And to bring you in, Matthew, if this is Al-Shabaab, as seems likely, certainly nobody else is claiming it and nobody is pointing at any other likely suspect, what is their ultimate, do they appear to have a strategy? Because I guess trying to look at it from their point of view, which is obviously a difficult thing to do, after an immense spectacular like Westgate, which succeeded in being one of those rare African stories which did grip the world's attention, this, at the risk of belittling the horror that it obviously is, does seem like a fairly low-rent enterprise.
Well, it would appear, to come back to your point about what is their overall strategy, Al-Shabaab is now part of a sort of a proliferation of these sort of franchise Al-Qaeda affiliated groups. There may not be necessarily Al-Qaeda core. Al-Qaeda itself is not a monolithic entity. It has splintered and spread. And now you have Al-Shabaab, you have Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, you have Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, you have Al-Qaeda in the Levant. So they have an overall ideology, which is, of course, they want to recreate an Islamic caliphate. They want nothing to do with Western modernity or liberalism, and they want the introduction of certain aspects of such as Sharia law, for example, or a sort of a Wahhabi-style government. That's what they want. They want an Islamic fundamentalist way of life.
James, this is obviously, I mean, the reporting of it from Britain at least is concentrated on the fact that a couple of British holiday firms have begun evacuating British holidaymakers. Any incident like this is obviously, it has a disproportionate effect. Kenya is an enormous country, most of which is a probably entirely safe one to travel in. Bomb in Nairobi, they evacuate people from Mombasa. at one level makes about as much sense as bringing people home from Spain because something's gone off in Holland. Are people overreacting to the threat?
Well, it's difficult to say because the reason why the companies have come back is not just because of the Nairobi bombing, but there appears to be some intelligence going round that it's Western targets are likely or are one of the likely targets. This has happened beforehand. And holiday firms have suspended things beforehand.
I mean,
then, fortunately, no one actually has been attacked since then. But I think how it works for the travel companies and for how it works for the travel companies is once they receive a certain threat level, they have to go back because otherwise, if something does happen, their insurance won't cover it. I think that's why they have to respond.
I think that there are insurance ramifications to continuing. Actually, I know there are because I've tried to insure myself at various points. That, yeah, if you go somewhere where the Foreign Office has said we really think this is a pretty terrible idea, then there are you do need to start reading your policy fairly quickly. Is that perhaps, I'll stay with you, James, for this one, part of the reason that Al-Shabaab, if it is them, are doing this? Because obviously tourism is hugely important to Kenya, and you can ruin a country's tourist industry with really a few very small attacks.
I don't think that Al-Shabaab are specifically targeting Kenya's tourists in order to kind of hamper the economy, but that doesn't mean that they're not doing it to do that. So there have been kidnappings of tourists from the northeast of the country beforehand. That was actually part of the reason that Kenya gave for why they invaded Somalia in the first place. And what they're trying to do is inflict a cost on the Kenyan people and on the Kenyan government for their continued operations in Somalia. But also, I think probably there is a kind of internal, making the troops feel good that you can inflict this kind of pain somewhere else, elsewhere. And I think it's more about those kind of internal psychologies rather than they've got a coherent strategy. This is the Kenyan economy. We need to take down this bit and that bit, and then we'll win the war. I think it's a bit more ad hoc than that.
On the subject of coherent strategies then, Matthew, does the Kenyan government have one? President Kenyatta has given the speech that leaders of countries always do at moments like this. You can hear all the key phrases without even needing to look it up by this point, unfortunately. As James was just saying, and as you were just saying, Kenya has previously pursued Al-Shabaab into Somalia, which I think is generally held not to have gone all that brilliantly. Do they have an option for dealing with them, or is this just a problem that Kenya is going to have to manage?
Well, they're going to have to work very closely, I think, with the West on this, because they don't have the technical capability, they don't have the reach, they don't have the resources, they don't have the technology that would enable them to deal with this threat as, say, a Western government could. So they're going to have to work very closely, and I've no doubt that probably they are already working closely with British intelligence, with French intelligence, of course, as well. And also, they're going to have to really take this on themselves, because they can get a lot of help and expertise and outside advice. But at the end of the day, it seems as if African governments will have to deal with this threat domestically, and they can't expect an external military intervention to help them. So they've got to get their act together and put the resources in place.
And they've got to make sure, the Kenyan government needs to make sure that it isn't stoking the flames of this, not necessarily in what it's doing in Somalia, but how it is dealing with marginalized Muslim coastal communities within which there is an Islamist current, and also within the Somali community, both Somali refugees who have settled in Kenya and also the Somali Kenyan population. Because recently there have been these big sweeps where they've just gone and gone into whole areas of Nairobi that are Somali and just arrested hundreds and hundreds of people and put them in stadiums before they're processed. And these kind of policies are likely to make the situation worse, to drive a very scary wedge between the Somali Kenyan population and the rest of the Kenyan population, or the Kenyan Christian population and the Kenyan Muslim population. So the government's got to be very, very careful with how nuances, responses.
This is the eternal difficulty of running anti-terrorist or counter-insurgency operations. Of course, it's not just Kenya's government that faces any government anywhere ever that's tried to respond to a terrorist threat. I can't think of one that's done it successfully without at some level inflaming the threat they were trying to establish, extinguish, just because you annoy so many people on the way while you're doing it.
Yes, but I think there's a large difference between going and incorrectly arresting, let's say, 20 people and maybe duffing them up a bit, and they'll be very upset, and you've upset them and their families and their communities.
Indeed.
It's what Kenya is doing is significantly worse than that, just in terms of the scale of the numbers and the very kind of arbitrary nature. It's in, oh, you look Somali, you get arrested. I agree with you entirely that there isn't really a counter-terrorism solution that has worked without annoying lots of people. But the Kenyan example is at the really extreme end of how to do that, with doing that in a very damaging way where you can really upset community relations in a long-standing way.
Okay, well, we'll move along now to Libya. And I think it's fair to say that Libya's immediate post-Arab Spring period has almost been enough to make people nostalgic for Colonel Gaddafi. The heaviest fighting since the revolution has been reported today in Benghazi, where local militias have been attacked from the ground and from the air. Now, this is an extremely peculiar story because, as of the most recent reports, Libya's actual government were claiming that they had nothing to do with it. So I'll ask you first, Matthew, who is freelancing with an air force in Libya?
Well, yeah, I know. It's an extremely confusing situation. And I think that just illustrates the fact that Libya is in a complete mess. The central government is very, very weak. It's trying to build up its military capacity. Its army, the national army, is still in training. So it doesn't have a great security reach and control around the country. And hence, you see these other militias that were instrumental in uprising against Colonel Gaddafi actually going their own way and freelancing. This is actually a very timely story because I think Libya, the situation in Libya, and also in particular Benghazi, because that word Benghazi has been coming up quite a lot in Washington recently, and I think that actually this will be quite a big issue in the US presidential 2016 election.
The attack, so some reports are saying, is being led by a gentleman called Khalifa Haftar, who's a retired Air Force general, was a commander of some note during the revolution. But this is deeply weird. I mean, it's one thing to organise a non-state militia. That's not actually terribly difficult in a place like Libya, which is awash with guns, dubious money, and people who don't have anything better to do. But to actually find yourself in command of a non-state air force, even if it's just for the afternoon, I can't recall many other examples of that happening. If Libya's government, and I'll put this this question to you, James, if Libya's government can't actually control its own air force, is it actually a government?
No, at this stage it isn't. I mean, it really isn't. They've had five prime ministers in the last bit of time. One guy resigned basically because people said, "We're going to come and kill you." So one of them got kidnapped. I mean, no, there is not a functioning government that has control over the military. And there are lots of different militias that have just as much military control or power as the central government. And in many ways, they're fighting each other, which is what we're seeing here in Benghazi. He's leading one, which my understanding is it's a more regionalist one versus the other Islamist militias that are also present in Benghazi. So, I mean, we really just have to view the central government as just one of the actors and not really sort of think, right, well, they control everything that says Libya National, whatever, on it, and all the other ones are the small ones that they've got to put down.
This is sounding like a scenario really not dissimilar to the last 20 years of Somalia.
This is true, and it's extremely worrying because the way in which the revolution or civil war or uprising, whatever you want to call it, the way in which it took place was highly decentralized, where local militia with various different interests, some of them have tribal affiliations, some of them religious ones, others regional, fought and won the revolution in their area themselves, which means that not only do you have people with lots and lots of guns, people now, because they've won a revolution, the leaders with very large egos and access to money, and they it has created a situation of warlords, effectively.
On that happy note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Matthew Jameson and James Schneider will still be here when we return. Up next, we're going to Nigeria.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 1822 in London. Still with me are Matthew Jameson, who's a consultant fellow at RUSI, and James Schneider, editor-in-chief of Think Africa Press. We'll head now to Nigeria, where President Goodluck Jonathan has cancelled a planned visit to Chibok, which is the northern town from where more than 200 schoolgirls were kidnapped last month by Boko Haram. President Jonathan is probably the person, well, one of the persons not the most deserving of sympathy in this scenario, but it's really hard to see what is a way for him to look good here. However, promising to go there and then changing your mind is definitely not how to do it. James, I'll ask first how... I mean, if there is a legitimate security issue here, which is entirely plausible, why would you say you're going in the first place?
Since this has happened, and sadly this is pretty representative of a large portion of the Jonathan administration and how it's been since he's been in power... has they changed their mind all of the time, and there is not coherent messaging at all, which is exactly what we've seen here. So they didn't actually, it's their classic action, they didn't actually announce that they're going to Chibok. Some, you know, one senior person told some journalists he's going to go to Chibok. It all gets announced, no comment coming back from the presidency saying, no, that's not true, we never announced that. So everybody assumes, therefore, it's an announcement. And so, I mean, what he really needs to do is get rid of anybody who has advised him in the last 2 years on anything to do with press, media, presentation, because it is appalling. And that is part of what is upsetting Nigerians who are protesting about it, is this seeming kind of lack of interest in what's clearly an enormous issue. They're not speaking about it about the abduction for 2 weeks afterwards. The feeling, which in many ways is pretty justified, that Jonathan thinks that the Boko Haram issue is kind of a political issue that is designed to undermine him rather than a serious terrorist insurgency threat which is damaging the security of his country. And so he really needs to get out somehow of the kind of court bubble which he's surrounded himself in and realise how he is being perceived, how he's rightly being perceived by most Nigerians now.
Matthew, I'll ask you the question I'm sure President Jonathan has asked himself more than once over the last few weeks. Does he have a good option? Is there anything he can actually do?
I think he can. I mean, he's no good. I mean, he's useless. The whole government is useless. I mean, they knew that this was going to happen. I was astonished. I read a report from Amnesty International, which said that there was intelligence and warnings 4 hours before the attack happened, that they knew that the Boko Haram fighters were on their way to abduct these girls. There's just such a callous sort of underlying sense of complete lack of care and indifference to this whole story, which I think goes to the heart of the problems with African governance still to this day, which is, as we're seeing in Nigeria, the government is completely unresponsive to the needs of the people. They don't listen, they don't engage, and not only that, the most fundamental duty of any government anywhere in the world is the safety and protection of the citizenry, and they have spectacularly failed on that, and they continually, repeatedly fail on that. So, I mean, the honourable thing for him to do would be to resign. I don't know whether or not there's anybody else who would be any better, but, I mean, it's a terrible situation, and I can tell you this, I don't have any hope or any confidence in the Good Luck Jonathan administration.
His resignation, of course, would appear to hand a significant, probably best to say another significant victory to Boko Haram, which obviously he would be unkeen on doing. Stay with you, Matthew, because James and I were talking the other night on a different Monocle 24 programme about the effectiveness or otherwise of, I guess, what you might call hashtag activism. Do you think the international and largely social media-driven online clamour about this story has helped keep it in the news? Because It was pointed out quite early on that if 200 white girls had been kidnapped in Europe, there would be nothing else on television.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And I mean, you know, James and I, we discussed this a few weeks ago before this whole social media campaign took off, because I was just really shocked that, you know, it was about 2 or 3 weeks into it and nothing had appeared in the Western media about this. And as you say, you know, nearly 300 girls have been kidnapped. It's the most unconscionable crime. And I think that it's brilliant that Mrs. Clinton kicked this social media campaign off. She, of course, you know, did her Twitter, Bring Back Our Girls, and there was all the follow-on after that. Personally, regrettably, I don't think really, I'm being a terrible cynic here, but I don't think it's going to make much difference because it's, you know, we say these things in a lot of hot air and so on, but at the end of the day, the situation is so terrible that really it's got to be the Nigerian government that does something. I mean, we can only, you know, say things from the West and you know, do status updates and pop little Twitter things, but they have got to be the people who actually get the girls back and rescue them.
It is indeed a horrible situation, which I suspect we're going to end up talking about again. Finally, we will go to Cairo, where there's another hardy perennial. We left ridiculous behind some time ago with this, but this bizarre prosecution of Australian journalist Peter Gresty and his Al Jazeera colleagues Baha Mohammed and Mohammed Fahmy has become even more absurd with the resignation of lawyers defending two of them. They seem to have acquired the idea now, their defence lawyers, that Al Jazeera is sacrificing its employees in order to pursue some obtuse vendetta against the government of Egypt. Are we buying this, James? I'll ask you first.
Not really, because Fahmy and Gresser were interviewed straight afterwards, and they both, according to the court reports, were completely baffled. They had no idea that their defence were about to do this, that they were going to do it in the most public possible way, which does make the whole thing seem slightly peculiar. I mean, the point that they're making, they could be making a coherent point. They happen to not really be, but they could, which is that Al Jazeera has issued a civil suit against Egypt saying we can no longer operate in your country because you are persecuting, and I think you used the right word when you had your Freudian slip there, because you're persecuting our journalists operating here. But there's another bit which is obviously beyond extreme, beyond absurd, which is the court is trying to charge the defence $170,000 to view the evidence that is being put against them, which is supposedly the doctored video reports that is the very basis of this trial against these three Al Jazeera journalists, which is that they were apparently making things up. And they are not being presented with the evidence. They're being made to pay to see the evidence that's being put before them. It goes beyond the joke.
This would, were it not so serious, have more than a whiff of a Marx Brothers script about it. Matthew, does Egypt have, or do the people, I guess, and I'll need a quick answer, unfortunately, because time is against it. Do the people running Egypt have any conception of, or indeed interest in, how completely insane this is making their country look?
No, I don't think so, because at the end of the day, the people running Egypt, as in most of these types of countries, are only interested and obsessed with power and their own power. And I would just say, you know, this is a prime example of, thank goodness, we live in a country like Britain, which has a fantastic rule of law spanning many centuries, and we have an independent judiciary. And that is, I think, what this case highlights. Egypt is lacking and desperately needs a proper rule of law.
And when Kerry Ashton and Blair are nice to the regime, no one's telling them they're stupid. It's just us sitting in a studio and everyone else in the world, but not the leaders.
Gentlemen, on that happy note, we will have to leave it there. Matthew Jameson from the Royal United Services Institute, James Schneider of Think Africa Press, thanks both very much for joining me.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦，这是 Monaco
24。Oplondo，Dubai Monaco 24。Fra
London， dette Monaco 24。From
London， this is Londres。Hollanda， London。London
으로부터 Hong Kong， Hong Kong，Zurich， London，
London。This
is Monaco 24。
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's instalment of Midori House. We'll be checking in with that woman in Amsterdam and also heading to the Cannes Film Festival. But before we get started on all that, Bill Bingham has the world news headlines.
And reports say as many as 13 people have died and at least 70 others have been wounded during two explosions in a busy market in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. One suspect has been arrested near the market where one of the explosions happened. Another was detained in another part of Nairobi. The blasts were caused by homemade devices. Narendra Modi says he wants to fulfil the dreams of 1.2 billion people after sweeping to power in historic elections in India. The final count has yet to be declared, but the Hindu Bharatiya Janata Party has surpassed the 272 seats needed to avoid a coalition, ending 10 years of Congress Party rule. Turkish police have fired tear gas and water cannon at thousands of anti-government protesters in the eastern town of Soma, where around 300 miners died on Tuesday. The protests happened after the mine operators held a news conference to deny any negligence over the disaster. A UN report says there's been a sharp deterioration in human rights in the east of Ukraine. A monitoring panel says between April the 2nd and May the 6th, police allowed armed militias to seize whole towns while journalists and local officials were unlawfully detained. And the US government has fined General Motors the maximum $35 million for postponing the recall of vehicles with faulty ignition switches. Those are the latest stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Bill. Welcome back to Midori House, live here from Midori House on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Muller. The time is now 18:33, near enough, in London. That'll be 21:33 in Moscow, 14:33 in Rio de Janeiro. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Amsterdam and Monocle contributor Cynthia Taylor. Cynthia, welcome to the programme. I was in Holland a few years ago reporting on Dutch attitudes to immigration, and back then the focus of everybody's concern and indeed paranoia was Morocco, but I understand it's now moved across Africa a little bit.
It has, and that's because the junior minister, Fred Teven, just said on television that there's been a dramatic, that's his word, dramatic increase in the number of asylum seekers coming from Eritrea in particular to the country. And he says that basically 2013, 1,000 Eritreans requested asylum in the Netherlands. And in the first quarter of 2014, that number has already been exceeded. Authorities cannot explain the influx. They suspect there's actually some activities of human trafficking behind it. And that's because all stories sound like copies of one another. They have the same answers in terms of the route they took, in terms of the expenses they've made. They're bringing in the same amount of money. And this influx basically has forced the government to open 4 more establishments this year to accommodate asylum seekers. Ironically enough, just 3 years ago, the government had decided to close down 7 of such places for a decrease in refugees. Now, the words by the junior minister have been criticized by the opposition. They do not believe that the numbers are that factual. On the other hand, the anti-immigration party Freedom has called the situation a disaster and has demanded the Dutch borders to be closed. Now, this follows a very interesting story, Andrew. You might remember that the Eritrean national football team disappeared 2 years ago in Uganda after playing a competition there. And they have been found living in the Netherlands. And the Netherlands welcomed the team of 17, including the doctor. And they are living in a small town about an hour drive from Amsterdam. And even the local football club has expressed interest now in welcoming the players to the team. But let's keep it real. This is just an amateur league.
Another thing that is upon us shortly are European elections. Immigration has been a huge deal where that's concerned here in Britain. Is it a major issue in European elections in the Netherlands?
It has been for the past years. And before, it was all about Eastern Europeans coming to the Netherlands and stealing the jobs of Dutch people. And now, of course, with news of this huge influx of people coming from Syria, people coming from Africa, the story is again, of course, in the debates regarding European politics. And it's all about, in the end, about economics, about, you know, how much money do we have to spend in welcoming these people here, and how much jobs will we lose by having people here. But to be fair, these elections do not really capture much attention of the Dutch. A recent survey said that 15% of Dutch people see some relevance, in fact, in European Parliament elections. There's a general lack of interest, there's little trust in European politics, and voters are not so well informed about the candidates. And in fact, polls suggest that only about 39% of Dutch will go vote next week on Thursday. Those are similar results to the last elections in 2010. But if you compare that, for instance, with the turnout to national parliament elections in 2012, that was 75%. And that was the lowest turnout for national elections in 14 years here. So it just reflects a bit the lack of interest that the Dutch have in terms of European politics.
Is it just indifference in Holland, or is there, because here in Britain there's a lot of indifference, but there's also in Britain a large strain of outright hostility. The party likely to come first, I think, in Britain actually wants Britain to leave the EU. Is there any actually anti-EU sentiment in Holland?
There is, it's a very, the studies what we're seeing here, studies are showing a very divided country. On one hand, we do have the anti-Islam, anti-immigration, anti-Europe Freedom Party coming very high on the polls. But then on the other side of the spectrum, we have the social liberal D66, which is a pro-European party, and is also coming on top of the polls. So depending on the study that's done, on the survey that's done, one of these parties, completely different, completely opposites, come on top. So you're seeing a very, very divided country here. Some people who have voted for more left-leaning parties are turning into a more central approach, pro-European, because some are getting tired of the rhetoric against Europe. But others are saying, you know what, we are tired of Europe. And a good example of that is, for instance, just like Britain, the Dutch are going to vote on Thursday. But they will not be able to reveal their results until Sunday, until the very last vote is cast in Europe. And people are saying, well, that's against transparency, that's against democracy. And there's even some a political blog that is calling people to go to the polling stations and to confirm there who has won in each polling station, because here everyone can go to the polling station and check the results, and all the results, after all the votes are counted, the results are just shouted out, announced out loud, so anyone can be president, know what the result of each polling station is. So people are saying, you know what, Brussels, no matter what you say, we're going to have it our way.
Finally, a television program, I understand, has caused a certain amount of controversy by failing to think through the idea that pointing hidden cameras at school children might not be such a brilliant idea.
Indeed. It's not the first time that such hidden cameras sort of procedure is used on Dutch television. The program in case is called Project P, and P stands for pesten, which means bullying in Dutch. And the whole concept was to just get one of the victims who's a victim of bullying to have a hidden camera and film the whole bullying taking place around it. And then the idea was to confront the educators and those and the bullies with what happened and try to solve the problem. Now, one school in particular said that although the program tried to conceal the images of the students involved, that they could still be identified. And they went to court, and the court has ruled that, in fact, the privacy of students is far more important than trying to solve bullying through these means, and has told the program, well, you cannot air these images. These images were scheduled to be aired next Monday. The television program, the producers said, well, we are not sure exactly what we're going to do about it. We definitely are not going to show the images, because if they do, they'll have to pay a fine of €250,000. But we will show the program anyway. This is a program that's new here. It's just airing for 3 weeks, but has already got a lot of controversy surrounding it.
Cynthia Taylor in Amsterdam, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. Up next, we will be returning closer to home, to the UK, to look at Bristol's booming independent media scene.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's time now for a preview of this week's edition of The Stack, which airs tomorrow. This week, we went west and followed Printout to Bristol. Printout events are run by Stack Magazines, a platform that shares independent publications and promotes print journalism. This edition of Printout was focused on Bristol's booming independent media scene. Monocle's Carlotta Ribello spoke with some of the editors and founders who crowded into Crofters Wright's pub and art space in the city.
Printout events promote quality print journalism with the goal of bringing industry aficionados together. For the first time, Printout has decided to leave London and go west. I followed along to Bristol to find out why the city is becoming such a bustling hub and home for independent media. Before the Printout event started, I caught up with some of the members of BIP, Bristol Independent Publishers, a new organization launched December last year. Daniel Humphrey is the editor of Off-Life magazine. He explained why Bristol is the place to be.
It's just the perfect place. I mean, there are so many amazing kind of artists, designers, cheap studio spaces, and you can afford to put all your time and energy into a magazine in Bristol. And, you know, the rent isn't huge here. It's not like if you're in London, you know, you couldn't just... I quit my job and just started doing Off-Life, you know, on a moment's notice. I was looking at London, I was looking at kind of Manchester, but yeah, it just felt natural to do it here. There's so many great magazines kind of popping up all over the city, and they're all independent, they're all kind of self-financed, and with all those things kind of coming up around you and being able to meet them and get advice off them, it just makes it a natural environment to do this sort of thing.
On a day-to-day basis, do you feel that connection between the independent magazines based here in Bristol?
I think so, yeah. So we started BIP, Bristol Independent Publishers, to really try and network these people, and not in a business, getting money off each other sense, but just share ideas. We kind of meet pretty much every week, at least one or two of us, you know, go and have a coffee and chat through any problems you might be having. And yeah, I mean, you see some of these magazines just in the last 6 months, their print run has doubled, their circulation has doubled or tripled. And yeah, I'd like to think that some of that community is, as you know, we're all helping each other on a daily basis. So
if for some, heading to Bristol was a conscious decision, for others it was already their home. Bone Shaker magazine, a publication focused on the human side of cycling, got its start from a workshop already established in the city. Mike White, the editor, explained why Bristol is right for them.
I think the fact that Bristol's a very free-thinking, creative city definitely helps. It has a very strong cycling culture. It was the UK's first official cycling city. And despite the hills and the awful roads, there are loads of really passionate cyclists. And there is a general atmosphere of the right kind of positive community. And I think Bone Shaker definitely feeds off that and hopefully contributes back to it as well. I think there are so many of the right ingredients to flourish as a creative person in Bristol that it naturally draws people in. It's sort of a magnet for them.
But are these magazines missing out because they are outside big global capitals like London? Rosa Park, editor of Serial magazine, thinks otherwise.
It's definitely not a constraint, especially not now. I mean, you know, you talk to most people on email, on Skype. I don't feel a great sense of geographical boundary. I choose to be in Bristol because this is where I feel I can do my best work. In terms of where I choose to sell and distribute the title, I mean, that is entirely up to me. And I am proud to be from Bristol, and we are a local Bristol magazine, but I am not limited to that. I think we were fortunate that we launched during a time when independent publishing was clearly thriving and on the rise. So as a result of that, we have been able to grow quickly, definitely quicker than I had anticipated.
The motto at Printout events is always the same. Print is not dead. Elliot J. Stocks, founder of Eight Faces and Digest magazines, believe there's still room out there for quality print.
I think it's kind of a symptom of where we are right now with our society, that because everything is digital, people are craving for something real, to actually have something they can hold in their hands, to have some beautiful photography, something that you can only really appreciate if you're holding the physical artifact. So because of that, I think independent publishing right now is enjoying a really massive boom, and especially in Bristol, because it's quite a small, close-knit community, into really interesting things. It feels like we're in the real right place and the right time to be doing these kind of magazines.
I wasn't involved in Bone Shaker.
The panel discussion lasted about an hour. It attracted people from all walks of life, various industries, students, creatives, and the curious passers-by. The event was a success, and it proved that Bristol deserves its spot on the media map. One of the organizers, Stephen Watson, who runs Stack Magazines, was telling me why we should take this community as an example.
Coming here tonight and packing out this room with people who are really passionate about these magazines, I'm genuinely quite taken aback. I think that the closest I've heard anyone come to it is talking about Bristol's history with independent media in general, and the idea that people here, if they like something, then they go with it. There seems to be like a slight kind of outsider spirit here, and that obviously plays in very well with independent magazines. I think because they're in it for the love, they want to see other people succeed as well.
For Monocle in Bristol, I'm Carlotta Ribello.
And you can, of course, hear the Stack at 10 a.m. London time tomorrow, and you can hear the Stack subsequently along with all of our other shows on our website or on iTunes. It's time now for a bit of music on Midori House. Up next, we will be going to the Cannes Film Festival. Taking us there, and this is very much the choice of our producer, Daniel Giacopelli. That's Daniel Giacopelli. This is Duran Duran with Girls on Film. Duran Duran, Daniel Giacopelli's favourite band, with Girls on Film. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's time now to finish off today's show by talking film. Film critic Tim Robey is at the Cannes Film Festival right now, and he joins me now to talk through four films that we need to know about in one way or another. Tim, so far in our conversations from Cannes, we've mostly been amusing ourselves by wailing upon Grace of Monaco, but it's probably time to admit that there are other films being screened. What has grabbed you so far?
Yeah, life is not just Grace of Monaco. There's been, so far, some very good stuff, actually. The competition has got off to a very good start, indeed. The first film I saw was an African film called Timbuktu, which is set in Timbuktu, and by the veteran Malian director, Sissako, Abderrahmane Sissako. And it's really good. It's a kind of a tract against Sharia law, and it sounds horribly brutal, and it's kind of based on the true story of a couple who are stoned in a small village in Mali. But actually, it's much more full of kind of life and joy and surprise than you might expect from such a film. And the imagery of stoning that we do get is just for a split second towards the end.
A few other films we need to talk about as well. Blue Room.
Blue Room is very good. This is Mathieu Amalric, the French actor, who you might know as the baddie in Quantum of Solace. It's his second film as a director, and it's called The Blue Room. His first one was here as well in Cannes a couple of years ago, called On Tour. And this film is a very tightly written and scripted drama about adultery, basically. It's only 75 minutes long, and it sets up the situation where Amalric, who also plays the lead role, is shuttling back and forth in time. And you realize that he's been having an affair, he's been trying to end it, and then something dramatic occurs, which causes him to be arraigned in front of a jury and have to kind of go through every detail of his kind of last year of playing both sides, as it were. And it's extremely good, I must say. It's done very economically, and it kind of grips towards the end like a thriller as you try and figure out exactly what's gone on between him, his mistress, his mistress's late husband, and his wife.
Well, we have a clip of Blue Room. It goes a bit like this.
Je t'ai fait mal. Tu m'aimes, Julien?
Je crois.
Je n'en ai pas sûr.
De quoi exactement avez-vous peur ce soir-là?
La vie est différente quand on la vit, quand on l'épluche après coup.
A clip from Mathieu Amalric's The Blue Room. We have been talking, as I mentioned, about Grace of Monaco, which is the very definition of a bad biopic. There is at least an attempt at a good biopic, which is veteran British chuckle merchant Mike Lee's portrait of JMW Turner called Mr. Turner. How does that go?
It's a successfully good biopic, I must say, partly because Mike Lee has really gone to a lot of effort to make it his most visually interesting film ever. It really is kind of quite lavish and gorgeous. His cinematographer goes to town. They're not just aping Turner's paintings. They're doing clever things where you think you're looking at a painting and you pull back and actually looking at a landscape that he's shot. Timothy Spall as Turner does one of his kind of big, big Mike Lee turns, I think. For me, going slightly overboard, and possibly I could have just done with a bit more nuance in that characterization, but there's loads of fantastic supporting acting work right down the line, particularly from Marion Bailey, who plays the kind of boarding house landlady who he kind of shacked up with in the last years of his life. She's great. And the young actor playing Ruskin as a kind of lisping fey critic, probably a bit of a dig there from Mike Lee at his own critics, good and bad, is extremely funny, I must say. It's one of his best, and it's a good shout for the Palme d'Or here, I think.
Well, we have a clip from Mr. Turner as well.
Mr. Turner seems to have taken leave of form altogether. Turner.
Clearly losing his eyesight.
The masterpiece I here present, which Mr. Turner has just sent.
I believe you to be a man of great spirit and fine feeling.
There's another film I wanted to ask about, that clip I should rather say from Mr. Turner, Mike Lee's portrait of the British painter. Another film I wanted to ask about just because everything I've read about it makes it sound like about the worst idea for a film I've ever heard in my life, The Captive.
Yes, well, I don't know if you saw Prisoners, the rather grim child kidnapping drama that Hugh Jackman starred in with Jake Gyllenhaal about a year ago. But this is very, very similar. It sort of begins and you realize that this couple have lost their daughter. She's just disappeared from the back of the truck. And again, a bit like with The Blue Room, you're jumping back and forward in time and you're having to figure out the timelines. And it's been an epic kind of 13-year search for her, which has not really gone anywhere. Ryan Reynolds plays the father. And it's not bad, actually. You know, as a Ryan Reynolds performance goes, I must say I thought he was pretty strong in it. Mireille Enos is his wife. I think she's great, too. It's directed by Axel McGoyan, who's been kind of off form, I would say, for the last few years, maybe even the last 10 years. And it is kind of silly. It tips over into ridiculousness because the paedophile character, who we meet very early on, in fact, in the first shot, is this Mozart-loving, polo neck-wearing kind of nincompoop who sort of struts around and has set up a whole basement situation with a girl. And to be honest, that characterization almost ruins the entire film on its own.
We have a clip from The Captive.
All right, what's going on? Ideas?
There's a kidnapper, and there's a watcher.
He might be watching me.
Who's watching you? Have you seen this girl?
Complete with portentous soundtrack. That is a clip from The Captive. Finally, Tim, I wanted to ask about Girlhood, which has been getting some very good notices.
Yeah, in fact, there's a somewhat less portentous soundtrack going on right behind me on the corset, so I hope that's not interfering too much. Girlhood's really good. This is not in the competition, actually. It's in the thing called Director's Fortnight. And it's a director called Céline Sciamma, who made a very good film called Tomboy about a 10-year-old girl passing as a boy. And this one is about slightly older teenage girls, all of them black, and all of them in kind of quite a deprived neighborhood, but trying to figure out where they're going in life, basically. It begins with the incredibly confident scene of them in American football gear, kind of charging to victory on the pitch, and then coming back home afterwards, kind of quite flushed with success. But then as they each traipse off individually into their rather grim, apartment blocks, you kind of realize they're actually still very vulnerable. And there's a lot of heart to the film. I think it's got an incredible amount of energy and definitely one of the best things here.
Tim Robey in Cannes, thank you very much for joining us. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Matthew Jameson from the Royal United Services Institute and James Schneider of Think Africa Press. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexandra Stenbock-Firmer, and our studio manager was Joel Church. After the headlines, the menu presented by our resident Finn-turned-New Yorker Marcus Hippie, and then at 2200 hours tonight, the Monocle Daily. This show will return at the same time on Monday, but for this edition of Midori House and me, Andrew Muller, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual Watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster Perpetual Watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.